It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up in just a bit, we'll talk with a guest who says the local food movement is failing to protect the workers it so heavily relies on. And she says that needs to change if we want to support ethical eating.
First, it's primary day for a handful of states throughout the country. Voters in Kentucky, Georgia, Pennsylvania, Arkansas, Idaho, and Oregon are taking to the polls. And the results will set the stage for some of the big races this November.
A handful of closely watched House, Senate, and gubernatorial primaries are at stake, with results offering clues to the direction of the November election and a look at the future of the Republican Party.
Joining us now with a look at what to watch for today is Steve Shepard, campaigns and elections editor for Politico. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start off in Kentucky, where Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell faces a Tea Party primary challenger. What are you watching for here?
Well, mostly we're watching for Mitch McConnell's margin of victory. Tea Party challenger Matt Bevin's campaign has largely fizzled out. Mitch McConnell has been very, very aggressive. He spent roughly $10 million on this primary of his vast war chest, and he still has in the high single digits very likely remaining in his bank account for the general election. Most polls show him leading by around 20 points, so that we'll have to see his margin. He needs to unify. In Republican-leaning Kentucky, he needs to unify GOP voters in order to win in the general election against Alison Lundgren Grimes, the Democrat who's going to have money to go basically toe-to-toe with McConnell come the general.
So 20 points seems like a pretty generous lead there. If he does prevail, as it looks as if he will, is it kind of a no-brainer that Tea Party supporters will come to his banner?
Well, Mitch McConnell's been in Kentucky for a long time, and his personal approval ratings and favorability ratings are not very good. He's not very well liked. Most polls show, while he's up by 20 points among likely Republican primary voters, when it comes to the general election, he's at best in a tied race with Alison Lundgren Grimes. So he does have his work cut out for him in the general, but for tonight, it's largely about his margin and to what extent he's able to consolidate that Tea Party support tonight.
And so you're going to draw lessons based on how big the margin is.
That's what I'm looking at right now, and that's going to, I think, give us our biggest clues about the extent to which Democrats can be competitive come November in Kentucky, which is not usually a state in which they're very competitive in federal elections.
So what would be a number that would give you some pause and say it's looking pretty competitive?
I think if he wins somewhere between 55 to 60% of the vote and Matt Bevin gets into the 40s, then you can look and say that there's a really sizable percentage of Republican primary voters who want someone other than Mitch McConnell to be senator come next year.
Hmm. Well, let's move on to Georgia. It looks like heading toward a runoff there. Who's looking strongest?
That's correct. If no candidate earns 50% plus one of the vote tonight, there will be a runoff in July. Right now, the strongest candidates are self-funding businessman David Perdue and Congressman Jack Kingston. They are the two most likely to make the runoff. A close third, though, is former Secretary of State Karen Handel. She's been supported by Sarah Palin and some conservative Tea Party-leaning groups. She has a chance to make the runoff. There are two congressmen who are a little bit lesser known who are likely to finish fourth and fifth right now, Congressman Paul Brown and Congressman Phil Gingrey. The interesting thing here is that for months, Republicans were very worried that either Brown or Gingrey would get into the two-way runoff and consolidate the conservative Tea Party vote. Both of them have a history of making some controversial comments, and with Michelle Nunn, the Democrat, daughter of former Senator Sam Nunn, so well-funded for the general, Republicans were worried that even though Georgia is another Republican-leaning seat, that they could have their work cut out for them if the nominee was someone that they didn't, you know, the establishment didn't really want. In this case, though, with Perdue has a lot of money, his own money. He's a former CEO of some big companies, including Dollar General. Jack Kingston is the choice of business. He's been endorsed by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and he's the best outside fundraiser in the race. So if you've got those two candidates in the runoff, Republicans who are worried about potentially losing the seat, they're going to feel really heartened that one of the nominees that they want is going to advance to the general election.
To what extent are you looking at all the results in these primaries and trying to gauge the strength of the Tea Party?
Well, there's another primary that we're really watching here, and that is in Idaho's 2nd Congressional District. Representative Mike Simpson is running for re-election. He's a friend and ally of Speaker John Boehner, which means he's drawn the ire of a lot of Tea Party groups who aren't happy that with the way Boehner's led the House and some of the votes that he's forced House Republicans to take that have in which he's passed bills like bills ending the government shutdown with a minority of Republican support. The Club for Growth, a conservative-leaning outside group, spent big for Simpson's opponent, an attorney by the name of Brian Smith. That spending, though, ended in late April as groups like the Chamber of Commerce came in for Simpson big, including a very expensive TV ad they aired featuring an endorsement on video from Mitt Romney for Mike Simpson. That's another race in which it appears there's very little polling in this Idaho House race, I would caution. But it appears, based on the spending trends, that the establishment has successfully beat back the conservative outside groups, the Tea Party groups. But obviously we'll have to see how the election results pan out because, like I said, there's not a lot of polling.
And there is a pretty, I guess, interesting is a mild word, gubernatorial primary in Idaho as well with some really interesting figures. This went viral. Some people said it ran like something out of Saturday Night Live. What happened?
Well, so Butch Otter is facing a primary challenge. He has one challenger who's a state legislator, and then two challengers who I would say a generous term would be a little bit more eccentric. If you haven't seen the video, I recommend checking it out. They provided a lot of comic relief to the debate. They sort of belie the Butch Otter did not run up a huge margin in his last primary victory in 2010, and he's faced some criticism from Republicans in the state for deciding to set up their own state health insurance exchange. Some Republicans regard that as acquiescing or participating in Obamacare, which is anathema to a lot of what they believe in. But he ran a TV ad defending that to Republicans, saying that we were going to do this the Idaho way, not let the federal government take over. He's hoping that is going to be an argument that carries the day. And like I said, if you have not seen the video of this debate last week, I seriously recommend checking it out.
And let's see, in Oregon, let's go there next. We've got a Republican primary that for weeks sort of looked like a lock for a candidate named Monica Wiebe. And now that seems as though it could be a little bit in question. Catch us up there.
That's true. So in recent days, both Democratic groups and both my news organization, Politico, and also the Portland Oregonian, discovered some old police reports dealing with Monica Wiebe, who's a pediatric neurosurgeon. Republicans were really, really excited about her candidacy. Even though Oregon is a Democratic-leaning state, they felt she had a very unique biography and could potentially put Senator Jeff Merkley's seat in play. But in recent days, there two police reports have been unearthed. Charges were filed in neither case, but in one, an ex-boyfriend accused Monica Wiebe of entering his home and basically stalking him. In another police report from divorce proceedings with Monica Wiebe's ex-husband, he accused her of harassment and other mild violence towards him. The one catch here is that Oregon votes entirely by mail, and a good chunk of the votes had already been received by the Secretary of State's office before the first of these stories even broke. So it's unclear to what extent they're going to have an impact on the actual election returns.
So it's possible that this is a scandal, if you will, that broke too late to make a difference.
Potentially, though, the fact that, Democrats have become a little bit concerned about Monica Wiebe's chances of putting the seat in play. They claim outwardly that Jeff Merkley is still well-positioned for re-election, but she does have a compelling biography. She has run some very, very good TV ads that involve parents talking about how she saved their child's life. They're very, very compelling. And, Republicans do think that if she can emerge from tonight's primary, that she has a chance to put the seat in play, particularly if the national environment remains favorable. And also, there's one other factor. In Oregon, the state had a very hard time setting up its health insurance exchange, so Republicans expect the health care law to be less popular there than it is nationally.
Steve, as you watch the returns from these primaries tonight, what are the big questions that you're hoping they might, if not answer, at least sort of hint at a direction?
Well, we're seeing, like we talked about in Georgia and Kentucky and the Idaho House race, the potential for the results to confirm that the establishment has successfully beat back some of these insurgent Republican groups. So look at Mitch McConnell's margin of victory. Look at which two Republicans, if it's Jack Kingston and David Perdue, who advanced to the Georgia runoff, that will be a good sign for establishment Republicans, and if Mike Simpson wins re-election. Beyond that, if Republicans hope they can get the candidate they want in the Oregon Senate race, that will bode better for their chances of winning the Senate back, as will getting the right candidates in Georgia, or the right candidates as viewed by some groups. The other thing I'm also looking at is the Pennsylvania governor's race. We didn't talk about this, but there's a Democratic primary to take on Republican Governor Tom Corbett. Corbett is basically the most unpopular Republican governor or governor of all altogether in the country, and the most vulnerable governor in the country. Democrats are excited about a self-funder by the name of Tom Wolf, who spent $10 million of his own money and has a pretty substantial lead in the polls leading up to the primary. The primary turned a little negative late, so we'll see if that brings Wolf's margin down or if he wins running away based on the strength of all the TV ads he's been running on the air in Pennsylvania since February.
All right, Steve, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Steve Shepard. Steve Shepard is a campaigns and elections editor for Politico.
In recent years, there's been a movement in the food world to buy local, support family farms, and eat more naturally. Our next guest says that's okay as far as it goes, but that we're ignoring a huge part of the story of local food, the reliance on migrant workers, and their well-being.
She says these workers are subject to long hours, low wages, and hazardous working conditions, and if we want the local food movement to succeed in an ethical way, we need to start protecting the workers at the heart of these farming operations.
We're joined now by Margaret Gray. She's an associate professor of political science at Adelphi University. She's the author of Labor and the Locavore, The Making of a Comprehensive Food Ethic. Margaret, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, you point out in your book that local, locavorism, whatever people want to call it, is held up as kind of a virtuous model of sustainable eating. But you say we're missing the story of the workers. Why hasn't that been paid attention to?
You know what? That's a great question. I think the main answer to why we've paid attention to the environment, why we've paid attention to the way animals are treated and to the plight of small farmers is that when it comes to the labor conditions, this is seen as actually challenging the farmers themselves. But I think the other side of it is that for the most part, what you read about the local food movement and what you read about the production processes, it's very romanticized. And I think we're often given the impression that these are teeny tiny farms, they maybe don't even have any workers. But I think given that we're told that almost everything else is better on smaller local farms, that we're also, it's easy to jump to the conclusion that working conditions are better as well. So I think there's two parts, our own romance with farms and the way that food writing has primed us to think that way.
So as you point out, just because a farm is small, just because it's a family farm, doesn't mean they don't have farm laborers. What you focused on the Hudson River Valley, but I think this is similar to places around the country. What were working conditions like for these farm workers?
Sure. So the first thing that I think listeners should keep in mind is that farm workers in most of the country do not have a right to overtime pay. They don't have a right to a day of rest, and they don't have collective bargaining protections. So, you know, I've met workers who are working 70, 80, 90-hour work weeks, and not just for 2 weeks of peak harvest, but repeatedly long hours and just getting paid straight minimum wage. So part of it is the law itself creates an opportunity for these workers to be exploited. I think the other thing to keep in mind is that the vast majority of farm workers are non-citizen workers, and they're afraid to complain. So they often don't want to say, hey, we're working too fast, or it's really too hot out, or are you sure that my paycheck is paid correctly? So part of it is also their own fear, and their fear to a certain extent is that they're going to lose their jobs, that they're going to be deported. But they've also heard other stories about workers getting fired for asking questions like this. So that's another part of it. And, you know, you can ask any farmer. Farm work itself is difficult work. It's all manual labor. And especially on, you know, Hudson Valley diversified farms, you don't have mechanization. So we're talking about all hand labor here.
And you talk to a lot of the farm workers, some of them undocumented immigrants, some guest workers. What did they tell you about why they did these jobs despite low pay, despite these tough working conditions?
Yeah, it's a pretty old immigrant story that they just don't have the same opportunity in their home countries. And so that's why they're here. They want to provide for their families. They want to put in a real floor in their home. They want to have indoor plumbing. They want to pay for medical bills. They want to send their kids to school. So in that sense, it's a sort of old story. They're also just acutely aware. So many of them have just a grade school education, and they don't have English language skills. And so there are very few jobs they feel are open to them, and farm work is one of the jobs that is open to them.
And you point out that often these farm workers might be provided with lodging while they work on a farm, or maybe food or other perks like that, but that comes, you say, with a downside. What is that?
Yeah, so I call this the price of proximity. So on the one hand, the proximity we have as consumers to local food is something we really enjoy. We get fresh food, they taste better, and we get to buy it not in a corporate grocery store. The flip side of that is that there's a price of proximity for these workers who are living on the farms. So as soon as your boss is in charge of some aspect of your life outside of work, that's a recipe for a paternalistic relationship to develop. And what happens with paternalism is that workers get housing, they might be able to take food from the farm, they might be able to use farm vehicles, maybe the farmer does them little favors to help them out. And I have talked to plenty of farmers, and I think that they often are doing this to be generous, that they want to help the workers. But the flip side is that the workers feel that they better behave really well in order to maintain those benefits. And so there are different layers of those benefits, and the more extensive the benefits, the more that they act as a form of labor control, because workers are interested in continuing to secure those benefits.
So you're not, well, not only is your job at risk, but maybe your home is at risk then.
Yes, exactly.
We just have a couple minutes, and I want to get to the consumer side. You point out the irony that there's a growing trend, some people maybe in the local food movement, asking how an animal was raised before they eat it, but not asking how the workers who raised that animal or the other foodstuffs are treated.
Yeah, so, I'm talking about a food ethic, and I take that directly from food writers like Michael Pollan. And I think when consumers want to know that the animals were treated well, it's about a food ethic. And so the same way that we've primed consumers to say, hey, ask questions about how much space these animals have, ask questions about the pesticide use. Nobody up until now has been priming us to ask questions about workers. So I think, I think this is the natural next step for the food movement to really embrace working conditions, improving them.
And does this all boil down to, even if we want local food, we want it to be cheap, there's this pressure on the farmer, and what do we do about that?
So, yes, I think this is definitely part of a much greater conversation about how cheap our food is in this country. But there's an agricultural economist, Philip Martin, at UC Davis, and what he showed is that if you increased farm worker wages by 40%, it would only cost the American consumer about $16 a year. And you also have the Coalition of Immokalee Workers in Florida, and they had a penny per pound of tomato increase, and that penny per pound increase has led to a substantial improvement in farm worker wages for those tomato workers. So, yes, I think consumers are going to have to pay more, but it's probably not the same dramatic increase that we expect if that money gets passed directly to the workers.
Margaret, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Take care.
We've been talking to Margaret Gray. She's an associate professor of political science at Adelphi University. Her new book is called Labor and the Locavore, The Making of a Comprehensive Food Ethic. figuring out the tip after a meal is just part of the way we eat out here in the United States. It can be a brain drain after a few glasses of wine and a heavy meal, or a headache for big parties. Sometimes the server gets stiffed on the tip, sometimes the service is bad no matter what you pay, but for some reason the custom of tipping keeps on going.
Our next guest says there's really no shortage of good reasons to just get rid of tipping already. Elizabeth Dunn joins us now. She covers food and travel in print for the Wall Street Journal and online for Esquire. Elizabeth, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So tipping your server in restaurants has been around for a long time. By now, we're pretty much used to it here. What bugs you about the practice of tipping?
So I think for me, it really all comes down to fairness and figuring out a way to compensate servers fairly. So a lot of people say that what they like about tipping is actually that they feel that it's a fair system in the sense that they can see what kind of a job someone does and then decide to sort of compensate them based on the job they did, the work that they did. But actually, when you look into the research about what motivates tip size and how tip size vary, it's really anything but fair. It comes down to a lot of aspects that are out of the server's control, like, for instance, how much you ordered, how expensive menu prices are, how full the restaurant is, and then also just aspects like the research shows that servers that are, you know, women will be tipped better than men, more attractive servers will be tipped better than less attractive servers, white servers will be tipped less than black servers. So these are all things that are not really how we like to think about compensating people in the U.S.
And it seems as though the food industry is one of the only industries that does this, that accounts for this variable to provide a big chunk of the server's wages. Why is that?
Well, I think originally it did start in the food industry. Tipping came over as practice from the UK and Europe, where it was used in taverns and bars and sometimes in private houses to tip the staff. But why it stayed as relevant as it has, I think it really comes down to customer preference. So people will consistently see a restaurant that has voluntary tipping as cheaper than a restaurant where the tipping would be rolled into the price of the food. And even though in the end the math may work out so that the place you tip costs you more at the end of the day than the one where you just pay the bill and the tip's included, people like to see that, you know, the $10 hamburger instead of the $13 hamburger, for instance.
Yeah, I've been at restaurants where the gratuity is included because maybe you're a big party, but I haven't been to a restaurant where the tip is already included. Are they becoming more common?
They're becoming a little bit more common. I think statistically speaking, it's still extremely rare. And it's still something that's really on the high end of restaurants. There are some of Thomas Keller's restaurants, for instance, which are very fancy places, not everyday places, have a mandatory gratuity of 18% that's just added in. Along the way, there's a place called Sushi Yasuda in New York City that has rolled the cost of servers' wages into the cost of the meal. So it's happening a little bit more, but it's far from common.
One really interesting thing that you write about, you say that, you know, if you talk to people, most people will say that they hate tipping, that it's kind of a drag and they don't like doing the math and all of the usual things. But in fact, people actually do like tipping when it comes right down to it. How do you explain that?
Yeah, they do. I mean, I think nobody likes actually having to fork out the extra money at the end of the meal and do that math. But people do consistently show that they will prefer a restaurant where they can choose the size of the tip to one where the wait staff is just compensated, you know, by the management. So I think it's just, again, that sticker shock argument of you see the menu price and that's how you're judging what the cost of your meal will be. And so, you know, the fact that gratuity is rolled in won't necessarily kind of factor into your mental process.
Do you think there's psychology involved in it too? The fact that if you get a really a server who is not delivering the kind of service you'd like, that you can, you know, a tip is a statement. It's not just money. It says something.
I think it really, people love feeling that they do have the option to do that. And it's a really tricky concept because what you perceive as a failing on the part of the server might actually be something that's totally out of the server's control. So, for instance, you know, you're interacting with the server, but the restaurant as a whole is such a, it's such a complex web of interactions and it's such a big team. So, you know, your drink might not have come in time because the bartender was behind, or maybe, you know, your food was cooked incorrectly and you kind of blamed the server for that. So that's a dangerous thing about tipping, I think.
You describe it as an obligation described as a choice, or, you know, sort of mislabeled as a choice. How do you see it?
Well, I think it's really confusing for people because it's called a gratuity. And so on the one hand, it feels like something extra you're doing for the server. But in actuality, servers are paid based on the assumption that the tips will make up most of their pay. And I think people understand that more or less. But what most people don't realize is that the minimum wage for tip servers in the U.S. is $2.13 an hour. So, you know, these people are really, their wages are really coming from your tips. So it is, in that sense, it is an obligation in the sense that what you decide to tip someone is determining their economic livelihood. It's not just a little something extra for them.
Do you have any sense about how servers themselves feel about tipping, whether they prefer to go to just a plain base salary or if they like it? I mean, I've been a server and I remember working, you know, some brunches, some high traffic times. And it would sometimes feel like you really made out well that day on tips.
Yeah, I think you hear a range of different things from servers. I've spoken to a lot of them after having done some of this writing on the topic. And they're nervous about the idea that if you were to eliminate tips, would restaurants really raise wages enough so that they were making the same amount of money. If you talk, there are a lot of servers who say, you know, I'm really good at my job and I feel like I make a premium because of it. And I love that about tips. But what you also hear from people, you know, who are junior in the industry or maybe not working at such lucrative places is that it's extremely stressful to not know day to day how much money you're going to bring home. And that really wears you down. And so it can kind of, what a lot of restaurant managers I've spoken to have said is they feel that it really works against the overall camaraderie of the restaurant because people are so sort of distracted by worrying about, am I going to be able to make ends meet?
We're going to go to our phone lines now. By the way, we'll be taking your calls throughout the rest of this this interview on tipping here. And you can join us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. How do you feel about tipping? Do you think it's a good practice or do you think it's just confusing and maybe it's not fair? We're going to go to Charlie in Milwaukee. Hi, Charlie.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I must say that in general, I have never liked tipping. I have always wished that it was done and added into the meal so I didn't have to think or anything like that regarding the tip for the server. However, there have been occasions where the server has been so good and so exceptional and added to the meal that the tip became a way for me to say thank you more than just saying you've done a great job. And there are times where I've tipped 25 to 30% on an expensive meal where I did feel that the wait staff added to the meal, giving suggestions, and truly making it a wonderful experience. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot, Charlie. And there we go again, talking about, you know, tipping being sort of a statement, a way to say thank you, which is, I guess, how it's intended. But what would you say to Charlie?
Well, I would say Charlie is somebody who we should all look up to because he's in the minority of people who actually use tips to really actively reward people in the sense of going above and beyond the 15 to 20% that's kind of considered standard now. I would say if tipping is eliminated and so you're no longer able to express your appreciation with money that way, a great thing to do instead would be to have comment cards for the restaurant. And so, you know, you can tell the owner or the manager of the restaurant what an exceptional job this person did, and you hope that it comes across in a bonus and a promotion. So you can still register your appreciation. It might not be with the cash in hand, but it's still possible.
See, that's interesting, though, because you finish a meal. The nice thing maybe about, you know, one of the nice things about ending tipping is that you could just pay your bill and you can leave. If you add comment cards, it's sort of another ritualized thing that you then have to go through. And instead of simplifying things, it just keeps it complicated.
That's true. I mean, you could also think about just, you know, mentioning something on your way out the door to the maitre d'. It sort of depends. I guess I would just say that for every Charlie who says, boy, this meal is sensational, I'm going to give 25 or 30%, there's more than one person who says, well, I'm in a bad mood and I didn't think this person paid enough attention to me, or, you know, she didn't smile enough. I think I'm going to give her 10%. So it definitely has, there's such a big downside to it that it probably more than makes up for the potential upside.
All right, let's take another call here. Brad is joining us next in Appleton. Hi, Brad.
Hello. Yeah, I just wanted to comment. It seems like a lot of places are doing split now, where it doesn't really matter if your waiter or waitress does a good job and you tip them well, because they have to share their tips with the rest of the staff, and that just doesn't seem fair either.
Okay, so the splitting up of the tip. What about that, Elizabeth?
Yeah, so tip pools, it's a really interesting subject, and it's something that's gotten restaurants in a lot of trouble over the years. And I believe the rule there is that restaurants are not allowed to ask servers to pool their tips and to use them to compensate non-tipped employees. So I think that's the rule, but otherwise the restaurant could and often does pool the tips. So it's a great point, because effectively once you're pooling tips, you're turning it into more of a wage, where people get a sort of portion of the overall take from the night. Most restaurants do it exactly because they want to insulate a given person from being really damaged by a bad tip. You know, if you were working a big table all night and they gave you almost no tip, that could make it difficult for you to make rent that week. So they're trying to keep that from being the case. But it also definitely does make it difficult for the tip to become really tightly correlated to the performance of the given server.
We're talking with Elizabeth Dunn right now. She says it's time to get rid of the impractical and unfair custom of tipping our servers after a meal.
We want to know what you think. Are you ready to ditch tipping? Do you work in the restaurant industry? What do you think of tips? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post over at the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Elizabeth Dunn right now. She says it's time to get rid of tipping. It's impractical, it's unfair, and maybe we should move on to a model where the tipping is included in the price of the food and the servers have a steady wage. We've got a link to her piece, Ban Tipping, on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we want to know what you think. Should we get rid of tipping, or do you want to make the case in favor of tipping? What do you think of it as a customer or as a server? Call 800-642-1234 or leave your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page.
Elizabeth, one thing I want to ask you before we go to our full phone lines here is you say that tipping does not make any economic sense. Why is that?
Well, not to get too wonky about it, but standard economic theory says that we usually give something when we get something in return. And so if I, pay you $2 and I get an apple, that's a transaction that makes sense. The funny thing about tipping is that it's money you give after the service has already been provided, and you're not actually obligated to give the money. It's technically optional. So it's not really clear economically why we would choose to do that. What if, if you're not planning on returning to the restaurant, which a lot of people don't, why pay money for something, a service that's already been rendered, when it's optional? So it's sort of a funny economic thing.
So I guess we could move to tipping a really big amount before we get served and then hope that
exactly.
The service matches it.
That would, in a lot of ways, make more sense.
All right, let's go to our phones. We got Mike on the line in Door County. Hi, Mike.
Hi. We recently took a motel shuttle from the motel to the airport, and it was early morning, and we were still kind of sleepy. And halfway in the ride, we saw a note that was taped to the back of the driver's seat. And it said, "I am a volunteer driver. Thank you for your generous tip." For one thing, it gave a very bad impression of the motel. What they can't afford to pay somebody to drive their vehicle. And I just wondered if that's something that's happening more and more.
Okay, interesting. I haven't heard of that. Elizabeth?
Yeah, I would say that's kind of shame on the motel for having somebody have to volunteer to drive their shuttle. That's not something that I'm aware is happening more, but I mean, it could be the case. I'm not that tied into the hotel or those areas of hospitality. So, gosh, that sounds pretty awful.
All right. Thanks, Mike. And let's go to Jason in Appleton. Hi, Jason.
Hey, I also agree. I have some friends, really close friends, that were over in Europe last year in England, and obviously, the same way, there wasn't any tipping there. The guy thought it was preposterous that they tried to tip. If they wanted to really get the bartender something, you could buy him a drink, but like he made a wage, his place of employment paid his wage. I can't even think of another example in the country here where where that method, that you know, that way works, where you don't have to pay your employees but require that the patron pay a substantial amount to the employees. We had Easter dinner with my family at like a buffet-style place, you know, a couple of weeks ago, and we were wondering about tipping there because they're the servers. I'm sure they're not making, you know, that they depend on tips as well, but they weren't really doing anything other than cleaning our plates off. So we were kind of confused, like, do we tip the same amount you'd pay a full server who was tending to you and bringing out your food and taking your order? Because it was a buffet, it was a little different, so that was a little bit confusing as well.
No, interesting. Some good points there, Jason. And that gets at the confusion that can surround tipping. Elizabeth, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's all part of the confusion. You know, what does it mean if you're someplace where it's not really full service, but there's some service? How about if you're at a bar and you're seated at a table and getting service from a server there, but it's for drinks? Do you still tip 20% on drinks, which seems to be really high? I'm interested also in bringing up Europe and how it works there. I hear from a lot of consumers who are worried that if you were to take away tipping, that service in the U.S. would get worse. And my response is usually, if you go to Europe or even further on the spectrum is Japan, where I think it's arguably the best service culture in the world, and there's absolutely no tipping. So those are sort of my arguments for it's not really giving servers the credit they deserve to think that they're only going to do a good job if there's extra money on the line. I think they care more about their jobs than that.
Well, and in terms of fairness, another angle here that we haven't talked about yet is, you write that servers seem to discriminate against some customers no matter what, and that's a pretty grim argument for getting rid of tipping. What did you find there?
Yeah, so this has some work done by a man named Michael Lin, who's a professor up at the Cornell School of Hospitality, School of Hotel Management, and he's studied tipping extensively in his work there over the past couple decades. And he has found that, you know, servers pretty quickly form stereotypes based on how different cultural groups tend to tip, you know, racially or in terms of age or gender, any of those things. And so they'll proactively give better service to a table that they feel is going to tip better. So, for instance, African Americans on average tip less than Caucasians. And as a result, they often, unfortunately, get worse service. And so it's something that is really perpetuating some pretty terrible stereotypes all over the place.
And this getting rid of tipping then would solve that kind of thing and level the playing field for everybody.
Yeah, exactly, because the server wouldn't have to be so concerned about where they're going to actually be able to make ends meet.
All right, let's go next to Luis joining us in Lake Geneva. Hi there.
How you doing? My name is Luis, and I currently waiter at Tempura House in Lake Geneva. And I, for one, don't discriminate to anyone I serve, because you never judge a book by its cover. And from my experience, whether it's Caucasian, black, white, any nationality, you get all across the board different tips. And it basically depends on the service you provide, how nice you are, how you come in, and how you provide that experience to those individuals. I believe that if tips are taken off, then there's definitely going to have to be an hourly wage suitable for the waiter to make a living, you know, whether it's minimum wage or $10 an hour. But basically, when someone's going to a restaurant, they tip those individuals based off of the experience that the food they got served. And that's basically all I wanted to say. But I totally believe that tips should remain. And those who do, you know, judge people, you know, just basically by color or ethnicity, those are people who shouldn't be waitering. Because if people who know they're going to a restaurant, they know that those people who are serving, the waiters and waitresses, are basically living off of tips.
All right. Thanks so much, Luis. Appreciate your perspective. Luis saying he doesn't discriminate when he's tipping and when he's serving, and he thinks that we should leave tipping in place. What do you think?
Well, I think that's definitely, it's unfair to say that, you know, certainly every server, the majority of servers are making the same types of calculations and they look at their guests. And so there are certainly many out there who are not discriminating at all when they're serving guests. But I would say in terms of, you know, worrying about, you know, thinking, because obviously Luis says, I do a great job and I feel like my tips go according to that. And I would hate to lose that based on, you know, being paid now by the restaurant. I would say that what you would hope to see in a situation where there were no longer tips is not just that then every waiter everywhere got the same wage and it was a minimum wage. What you would expect to see and what I would hope to see is that the wages would vary according to all the different reasons why wages vary in any profession. So if you're a really experienced, really great server, you're going to get paid more than somebody who's less experienced and maybe not as good. So you will still see you'll still see a benefit to doing a really great job.
Okay, let's take another call here. We have Jim joining us from Waukesha. Oh, and by the way, Luis, thank you for calling. Jim, hi.
Hi, how are you? Thank you very much.
Sure.
This is an interesting topic. I have two daughters that spent summer jobs for 2 summers working at the same restaurant. I mean, they could be mistaken for twins, so I'm going to take away the what they look like part. One would consistently make $75 a day, and one would consistently make $150 a day, working the same tables at the same shifts. And one of them just looked at it as, you know, this is just a job, and I'm just going to take whatever I get. My other daughter looked at it as an entrepreneurial opportunity where she was in control of what she earned, and she really worked hard to perfect her craft, and she made at least double every single night.
Okay, so interesting. Thank you, Jim. And Elizabeth, do you want to speak to that? Do some servers really stand out and therefore bring home a lot more money?
Yeah, I think what's sort of interesting to look at is the types of things that a server can do to change how much they make. So there are some concrete and sort of funny things you can do as a server to up your wages. So one is, for instance, putting a smiley face on a check, but only if you're a female server, that seems to work. Making body contact with the table. So for instance, putting an arm on somebody's shoulder briefly, or a hand on someone's shoulder briefly and touching them. Kneeling down next to the table has been shown to increase tips. So there are things you can do. I don't know whether those things actually add up to what I would call better service as much as sort of tricks of the trade. But there are certainly things you can do to motivate better tips.
And we'll leave it there. Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Elizabeth Dunn. She writes for The Wall Street Journal and Esquire.